The Principles of the Most Ancient and Modern Philosophy by Anne Finch, Viscountess Conway, first published in 1690. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 7. Body and Spirit: Three Arguments. My thesis about body and spirit implies that the nature of each body is that of a life or spirit, which has the power of perception and is also capable of sense and thought, love and desire, joy and grief, and consequently that each body can act and move on its own initiative, putting itself wherever it wants to be. I want to explain more clearly what my case is for all this. My first reason comes from the three-part classification of things that I have presented: God, the highest; Christ, the intermediate being; and the creation, the lowest rank. So far as its nature or essence is concerned, this creation is one entity, one substance, as I have shown, so that it varies only in its modes of existence, one of which is corporeality. The body/spirit difference is a matter of degree. A thing can be pretty close to being a body, i.e. quite a long way from being a spirit. And because spirit is the more excellent of the two, in the true and natural order of things, the more spiritual a creature is, the closer it is to God, unless it degenerates in some other way, because God, as we all know, is the highest spirit. So a body can become more and more spiritual without end, because God, the first and highest spirit, is infinite, and can't have any corporeality in his constitution. It is indeed in the nature of a creature, unless it degenerates, to become ever more like the Creator. But no creature can become more and more corporeal without end, in the way it can become more and more a spirit. Why the difference? Because nothing is, in every way contrary to God, infinitely and unchangeably bad, as God is infinitely and unchangeably good, infinitely dark as God is infinitely light, infinitely a body with no spirit, as God is infinitely spirit with no body. So nothing can become darker and darker to infinity, although it can become brighter and brighter to infinity. And nothing can go from bad to worse to infinity, although anything can become better and better to infinity. Thus, in the very nature of things, there are limits to evil, but none to goodness. And every degree of evil or sin has its own punishment, which is appropriate to the nature of the case, and this punishment turns the evil back towards good. Each sin has its punishment stored within it for future use, though the sinner doesn't realize it while the sin is going on. And when the right time comes for this, the punishment will be unleashed, and the sinner will feel the pain of it. This will return him to the original state of goodness in which he was created, and from which he can't ever fall again, because this great punishment has made him stronger and more perfect, so that he rises from his previous indifference of will, regarding good and evil, to a level at which he wants only to be good, and is incapable of wishing any evil. From this we can infer that all God's creatures that have fallen, i.e. come down from their initial goodness, must in due course be raised again to a condition that is actually better than that in which they were created. God is incessantly at work, so it's the nature of every creature to be always in motion and always changing from good to good, from good to evil, or from evil back to good. It isn't possible to move forever towards evil, because there's no such thing as infinite evil. So it is inevitable that every creature will at some time turn again towards good, because the only alternative is to stop changing altogether, and that is contrary to nature. You might want to suggest another alternative, namely that the sinful creature falls into eternal torment. I reply, if by eternal you mean lasting through an endless infinity of ages, what you are suggesting is impossible, because all pain and torment stimulate the life, the spirit, of the sufferer. We have plenty of experience of the truth of this, and it also stands to reason, pain and suffering reduce whatever thickness or lumpiness the spirit or body is afflicted by. So the spirit that was imprisoned in such thickness or lumpiness is set free, and becomes more spiritual, and, therefore, more active and effective, this being achieved by pain. So there we have it. A creature can't proceed for ever toward evil, or fall into inactivity, or spend an eternity in suffering, from which it irrefutably follows that the creature must return toward the good, and the greater its suffering, the sooner it will make that return. We see, then, how something, while continuing to be the same substance, can wonderfully change its state, so that a holy and blessed spirit, or an angel of light, may become an evil and cursed spirit of darkness through its own willful actions. This change or metamorphosis is as great as what happens when a spirit becomes a body. Does such a spirit become more corporeal than it was originally, before its wrongdoing pulled it down? Yes, it does. And I have already shown that a spirit can become more or less corporeal. It's a matter of degree, though it can't move in that direction to infinity. Spirits can remain for long periods of time without any of the bodily lumpiness characteristic of visible things in this world, such as rocks or metals or the bodies of men and women. For surely, even the worst spirits have bodies that are less lumpy than a visible body is. Yet all that lumpiness of visible bodies comes from spirits having fallen from their original state. Because of this thickness, spirits can in time, how much time varies, shrink and pull into themselves. This can't happen all at once in a general way, so that the entire body of a fallen spirit becomes equally lumpy in all its parts. Rather, some parts become ever thicker, while other corporeal parts of this spirit retain a certain tenuousness, a certain thinness or fluid quality. If they didn't, the spirit couldn't be as active or mobile as it is. The principal spirit, together with as many of its subordinate spirits as it can gather together, along with those more finely divided and tenuous parts of the body, pulls away from the lumpier parts of the body, abandoning them as though they were so many dead corpses that can no longer serve those same spirits in their operations. This departure of subtler and stronger spirits from the thicker and harder parts of the body into the vicinity of better and more tenuous ones can be seen in the behaviour of alcohol that freezes when subjected to extreme cold. If the parts of a body near the surface are frozen by the external cold, and the stronger spirits have avoided that by moving in towards the centre of the body, where the matter is more tenuous and where everything is warmer, then any single drop of alcohol that escapes freezing by moving into the warm centre has more, many times more, strength and vigour than all the parts that are frozen. Moving on now from that to a different point, we must recognise that thick, lumpy bodies are of two kinds. Bodies of one kind can be seen and felt by touch. Those of the other kind are invisible and impalpable, can't be felt by touch. And yet they are just as thick as the others, indeed, often thicker and harder. Though these impalpable bodies don't affect our outer senses, we can perceive them internally by our inner senses. They are extremely hard, harder in fact than any flint or metal that our hands can hold. Visible water is composed of these small, hard bodies. It appears to us quite soft, fluid and tenuous, but that is because of the many other subtle bodies that continually stir and move the hard particles, so that a portion of water appears to our crude senses as one simple and homogeneous thing. Actually, it consists of many dissimilar parts, more so than most other bodies. Many of these parts are quite hard and pebble-like. They are the source of beach sand, and other sorts of gravel and stones that come from the water in the depths of the earth. When these little pebbly particles of water grow into visible gravel and stones, they eventually lose their hardness and become softer and more tenuous than they were back when they were part of the water. stones decay and turn into soft earth, from which animals come. Indeed, decaying stones often change right back into water. But this is a different sort of water from before, because one of them hardens while the other softens. You can see this in the two kinds of water that flow from one mountain in Switzerland. Drinking one produces kidney stones. Drinking the other dissolves them. That's why it is right to say that the heart or spirit of a wicked man is hard or stony. His spirit does have real hardness in it, like that found in those pebbly little particles of water. And why it is right to say that the spirit of a good person is soft and tender. We can really feel the inner hardness and softness of spirit, and any good person perceives this inwardly, but as tangibly as he can feel the outer hardness of lumpy external bodies with his hands. People who are sunk in their sins have no feeling for the hardness or softness of good or bad spirits. So they think that softness of spirit, hardness of heart, and so on, are mere metaphors, when really they have a literal meaning with nothing metaphorical about it. My second reason for holding that created spirits can change into bodies, and bodies into spirits, is based on a properly serious consideration of God's attributes. The truth of everything can be declared by those attributes, as though they were a treasury of learning. God is infinitely good, and communicates his goodness to all his creatures in infinite ways. So every one of his creatures receives something of his goodness, and receives it in the utmost fullness. And his goodness is a living goodness, containing life, knowledge, love, and power that he communicates to his creatures. So how could he be the source or creator of anything dead? For example, of any mere body or matter of supposed sort that can't be changed into any degree of life or perception. It has been truly said that God didn't create death. It is equally true that he doesn't create anything that is dead, for how could a dead thing come from him who is infinite life and love? How could a being as infinitely generous and good as God give any creature an essence that is so low down and diminished that it has no part in life or perception, and has no hope of the least degree of these for all eternity? What was God's purpose in creating anything? Wasn't it so that his creatures could be blessed in him, and enjoy his divine goodness in their various conditions and states? How could such enjoyment be possible without life or perception? How can divine goodness be enjoyed by something that is dead? I will now carry this argument further. It is customary and correct to divide God's attributes into those that can't be communicated, i.e., shared with anything else. God's subsisting by himself, and his being independent, unchangeable, absolutely infinite, and most perfect. And those that can be communicated, God's having spirit, light, life, his being good, holy, just, wise, and so on. Every one of these communicable attributes is alive, is indeed life. Now, every creature shares certain attributes with God. So which of his attributes is it that produces dead matter, body, that is forever incapable of life and sense? You may say, a portion of dead matter has something in common with God, namely, being real or having an essence. I reply, there can't be any dead reality in God, for the creature to share in. So it will have to have its own dead reality. Besides, reality is not, properly speaking, attributed to something. But what is properly attributed to something is what is predicated or affirmed about that reality. So there are no attributes or perfections that can be attributed to dead matter and analogously to God. Also, God's creatures, just because they are creatures, must be like their Creator in certain things. Well, in what way is this dead matter like God? If you say they are alike in having sheer reality, I reply that there can't be anything like that either in God or in creatures, so it is mere unreality. As for the remaining attributes of matter, impenetrability, shape, and motion. Obviously God doesn't have these, so they aren't among his communicable attributes. Then what are they? They fall within the scope of an attribute of creatures that they don't share with God, namely, changeability, because impenetrability, etc., are simply respects in which creatures can change. Thus, since dead matter doesn't share any of God's communicable attributes, we have to conclude that dead matter is completely unreal, an empty fiction, an illusion, an impossible thing. You might try, every being is true and good, so dead matter has metaphysical truth and goodness. Well, what is this truth and goodness? If it has no overlap with any of God's communicable attributes, then it isn't true, isn't good, isn't anything. And there's a related point. Since we can't say how dead matter shares anything with God's goodness, we are even further, much further, from being able to show how it can reason and can grow in goodness to infinity. And I have shown that it is the nature of all creatures to do that. If you aren't convinced, consider, what progress in goodness and perfection can dead matter make? After a portion of matter has gone through infinite changes of motion and shape, it is still compelled to be as dead as ever. And if motion and shape contribute nothing to life, this matter can never improve or progress in goodness in the smallest degree. Here is another attempt to escape my conclusion that dead matter, if there were such a thing, could never come alive. This dead matter, this body, might go through all the shapes and physical configurations there are, including utterly regular and precise ones, making a body that is a complex, beautifully functioning machine. But what good is that to the body when it still lacks all life and perception? Well then, we could suppose this. A portion of matter has gone through an infinity of motions from the slowest to the fastest, a process in which it becomes better because of a certain inner power to improve itself. But a body could have such an intrinsic power only if its nature required it and brought it about. And the nature of a sheerly dead body doesn't require any kind of motion or shape, and doesn't improve itself by selecting one motion or shape rather than another. My third argument is drawn from the great love and desire that each spirit or soul has for bodies, and especially for the body that it inhabits, and is united with. When one thing is brought towards another by love or desire, that is because they are of one nature and substance, or they are like each other or are of one mind, or one owes its existence to the other. We find examples of this among all animals that produce their own offspring in the way human beings do, in which a parent loves what it has given birth to. Thus, even wicked men and women, except for the extremely perverse and profligate, love their own children and cherish them with natural affection. That's because their children are of one nature and substance with them, as though they were parts of them. And if their children resemble them in body, spirit, or behavior, this increases the parents' love still further. We also see that animals of the same species love each other more than animals of a different species. Farm animals of one species graze together. Birds of one species fly in flocks. Fish of one species swim together. And men prefer the company of men to that of other creatures. In addition to this particular love, there is also a certain universal love that all creatures have for each other, despite the great moral mess that resulted from the fall. This is a natural and inevitable upshot of the same fundamental fact that all things have a basic substance or essence that makes them one, like organs or limbs of a single body. Also, we see in every species of animal that males and females love each other, and that in all their matings, except abnormal and unnatural ones, they care for each other. This comes not only from their unity of nature, but also from their conspicuous similarity to each other. These two foundations for the love between men and women are explicitly mentioned in Genesis. The unity of their nature comes in when Adam says of his wife, "She is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh," etc. She loved him because she was taken from him and was part of him. The similarity comes in here. No helpmate was found for him until Eve was made. Among all creatures he saw no one like himself with whom he could associate until Eve was created for him. A third reason for love comes into play when two beings who are not one substance nevertheless love each other because one of them has brought the other into existence and is its genuine and real cause. That is how things stand with regard to God and his creatures. He gave existence, life, and motion to everything, so he loves everything, and can't not love everything. When he seems to be angrily hostile to his creatures, this anger and the punishment and judgment that come from it are for the creatures' good, meeting their needs as God sees them. And in the other direction, God is loved by every creature that isn't altogether degenerate and lost to all sense of God. The creatures that most resemble God love him more and are more loved by him. You might say that the principal cause of love is goodness. Creatures love God because he is so good, and love one another because they, rightly or wrongly, see one another as good. Well, goodness is the greatest cause of love, but it isn't a fourth reason for love, additional to the first three, because it is included in them. Why do we call something good? Because it pleases us on account of its real or apparent similarity to us. This is why good people love good people and not others. For good people can't love bad people, and bad people can't love good ones. Taking this as a touchstone, let us now return to our subject, the unifying thread through this chapter, namely, the question of whether spirit and body are of one nature and substance, and therefore able to change into each other. Tell me what the explanation is of the following well-known fact. The human soul or spirit loves the body so much, unites with it so tightly, and parts company from it so unwillingly, that in some cases a person's soul remains with his body and remains subject to it after the body has died, decomposed, and turned to dust. The reason for this love can't be that the spirit or soul gave the body its separate existence, or that the body did this for the spirit, because that would be, speaking strictly and literally, creation, and that is solely the function of God and Christ. Therefore, the love I have asked about must occur because of the similarity or affinity between the natures of the soul and the body. What is that goodness in the body that makes the soul love it so much? What are the attributes or perfections in respect of which a body resembles a spirit if the body is nothing but a dead torso, a mass of matter that is quite incapable of any degree of life or perfection? You may say, a body agrees with a soul or spirit in respect of being or reality. Just as the spirit has being, so does the body. I have already refuted this, but will give the refutation again, filling in its details a little. If this being, this supposed being, this lump of permanently dead matter, has no attributes or perfections matching those of a spirit, then it's a mere fiction. God hasn't created any bare being, i.e., something that is only mere being, with no attributes that can be predicated of it. Being is merely a logical term and concept. As a bare and abstract notion, it doesn't exist as a reality in things themselves, but only as a concept in the human mind. For this reason, every being has an individual nature with certain ascertainable attributes. What attributes does a body have similar to those of a spirit? Let us look into the principal attributes of the body that make it different from the spirit, according to the view of those who hold that body and spirit are so utterly distant in nature that neither can become the other. There are two of these attributes. Each body is impenetrable by all other bodies. The parts of different bodies cannot penetrate each other. Each body is divisible. In contrast with this, the people whose views I am examining hold that spirits are penetrable, one spirit can penetrate another, a thousand spirits can exist within each other, taking up no more space than one spirit, and spirits are so simple and unified that no spirit can be separated, dismantled into really distinct parts. Now, I have said that similarity is the true basis of love and unity, but if we compare the above attributes of body and spirit, we see that far from having any similarity or natural affinity to each other, they are flat out opposites. In the minds of these people, it is inconceivable that anything else in the entire universe is as contrary as our body and spirit. Black and white? Hot and cold? No, because black can become white, and hot can become cold, whereas, they say, something impenetrable can't become penetrable. Not even God and creatures are as utterly different in their essence as body and spirit are, according to these people. God shares many of his attributes with creatures, but we can't find any attribute of body that in any way matches an attribute of spirit, or, therefore, of God, who is the highest and purest spirit. If they were right about this, body couldn't be created by God, and must be merely non-being or a fiction. Here is a reply that might be made to that. Body and spirit do share certain attributes, such as extension, motion, and shape. A spirit can stretch from one place to another, can move from place to place, and can change itself into any shape it pleases. In response to this, I say, as I did earlier, that a spirit can have extent, though that is denied by most of those who claim that body and soul are essentially different. But there's a terrific difference between the extension of spirit and the extension of body, as those folk understand it. Where body is concerned, extension and impenetrability are really only a single attribute, conceptualized in two different ways. If a body, X, doesn't impenetrably keep other bodies out of a given region, what content is there to the statement that X is in that region? Furthermore, according to the thinking of the people I am criticizing, the extension of body is utterly different from that of spirit. A body's extension is so necessary and essential to it that it couldn't possibly have been more or less extended than it is. Whereas a spirit, according to these people, can be extended more or less. And since the ability to move and to have a shape stand or fall with extension, what I have said about extension holds equally for those other two attributes. And there is a more direct reason for holding that spirit has shape and mobility in a very different way from body, namely that a spirit can move and shape itself, which a body cannot do. Anyway, what's going on when they declare that impenetrability is an essential attribute of the body and penetrability an essential attribute of spirit? Why can't a body be more or less impenetrable and spirit more or less penetrable? That's how it is with other attributes. A body can be more or less heavy or light, dense or rare, solid or liquid, hot or cold. So why can't it also be more or less impenetrable? They may say, we always see that a body, when it goes through these other changes, remains impenetrable. For example, when iron is red hot, it is still impenetrable. I agree that the red hot iron is not penetrable by any other equally coarse body, but it can be, and is penetrated by a more finely divided body, namely the fire that enters it and penetrates all its parts. This softens it, and if the fire is strong, it completely liquefies the iron. The people I am arguing with might respond, this incursion of fire into the iron isn't penetration in the philosophical sense, i.e. it doesn't enter it in such a way that fire and iron occupy only one place, and are therefore most intimately present one to the other. The supposition that it does is flatly contradicted by the facts. Red-hot iron swells and takes on greater mass than when cold, and when cooled it becomes hard again and returns to its former size. To this I reply that if they are using penetration to mean what we call intimate presence, in which a homogeneous substance enters into another of equal size, without increasing its size or weight, this appears altogether irrational. It is utterly impossible. It would be downright contradictory for any creature to have the power of such intimate presence. Only God and Christ, as creators, have the privilege of being intimately present to creatures. If a creature could be intimately present to another creature, it would stop being a creature, because it would now have one of the incommunicable attributes of God and Christ. This attribute should be ascribed primarily to God, and secondarily to Christ, because he is the intermediate being between God and creatures. Christ comes into this on the strength of his intermediate position, just as he is involved in changeability and unchangeability, and in eternity and time. He can be said to be involved in spirit and body, and thus in place and extension. His body is a different kind of substance from the bodies of all other creatures, so there is no absurdity in supposing that he is intimately present to creatures, but he isn't to be confounded with them. To suppose that one creature can be intimately present to another, mingling or uniting with it in a most perfect way without increasing its weight or extension, blurs the distinctions amongst creatures, and makes two or more of them into one. Indeed, this hypothesis implies that the whole creation could be reduced to a tiny particle of dust, because any part could penetrate any other without increasing its size. My opponents may reply, "That only proves that spirits can be reduced to a tiny space, but not bodies, because they are impenetrable," to which I respond that they are begging the question, because they haven't yet proved that body and spirit are different substances. If they aren't different, neither of them is any more penetrable than the other, according to the views of the people I am attacking. If you question whether an item could be unable to be intimately present to any other of the same kind, and yet able to be intimately present to something of some other kind, consider the case of time. It's easy to see that time is extended in such a way that no part of it can be intimately present in any other part. The first day of the week can't be present in the second, or the first hour of the day in the second, or the first minute of the hour in the second. That's because it is the nature and essence of time to be successive, one part coming after another. Yet God is really and intimately present in all times and doesn't change. Not so for creatures, however, because they continually change as times change. For time is nothing but the motion or change of creatures from one condition or state to another. Just as this is how things stand with regard to time and creatures in time, it's the same for mass or quantity. Whereas in God there is no time, and no mass or corporeal quantity. In creatures there are both. If there weren't, the creatures would be, impossibly, either God or nothing. And the kind of quantity, mass, and extension that any creature has is essential to it, just as it's of the essence of time that it consists of many parts, which have parts, which, and so on, to infinity. We have no trouble grasping how a shorter time is nested within a longer one, 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, although 1 hour immediately borders upon the next and cannot be present in it. That's how it is with creatures in respect of their spatial extent, i.e., their mass and size. One creature can touch another, but can't be present in all its parts. But a smaller body can be in a larger one, and a more finely divided body can be in a body whose separate parts are larger. This last is the kind of penetration that bodies can properly be said to engage in. A body can be penetrated by another body more finely divided than it is, but not by one equally or less finely divided. Similarly with souls, which have bodies, and can therefore be distinguished into more and less finely divided. Actually, the difference between more and less finely divided is the difference between body and spirit. In saying this, I turn my back on the thesis that body is merely a dead thing, lacking life and the capacity for life, in favour of the view that body is an excellent creature of God that has, actually or potentially, life and sensation. That goes with the fact that the word spirit comes from air, which has the most finely divided nature in the visible world. Spirit is better defined in a Kabbalist writing. A spirit is defined as a central nature that has the ability to emit a luminous sphere and to control its size. And later, in the same work, matter is defined as a pure center or a point without a radius. From this we must conclude that the impenetrability of creatures must be limited to their centers. The Hebrew word ruach, which means spirit, also signifies air. It's because air moves so fast that in any moving body, all the swiftness of its motion is attributed to its spirit. When seeing no motion in bodies, common people in their ignorance call them dead, and say they have no spirit or life. But in fact, there's no such thing as a dead body. Each body has motion, and consequently life or spirit. So every creature, spirit as well as body, has its own appropriate weight or extension which cannot be made larger or smaller. This doesn't prevent us from seeing how a tiny body can expand to 1,000 times its former size, as happens with the amazing expansion of gunpowder. All this expansion comes from bodies being divided into smaller and smaller parts. They don't truly fill the whole of that larger space, because the sum of the size of these tiny parts exactly equals the size of the original nub of gunpowder. We have to conclude from this that whenever a created spirit is in a body, either it occupies pores, or it makes the body swell to a larger size in the way I have described for gunpowder, as when fire enters into iron and makes it swell. This swelling can and sometimes does occur on such a small scale that we can't see it. It could even happen on such a small scale that it couldn't be expressed in numbers. Now let us turn to the second attribute, said to be possessed by bodies but not by spirits, namely divisibility. If they, the people I am opposing, are saying that each body is divisible, so that even the smallest conceivable body can be divided, this is plainly impossible, a contradiction in terms, implying that the smallest creature can be divided into smaller parts. Thus, if a body is taken to refer to one single individual, then each body is indivisible. When we speak of bodies as divisible, we usually mean that we can separate one body from another by placing a third body between them. And in this sense, spirits are as divisible as bodies. A single spirit can't become two or more spirits, any more than a single body can become two bodies. But several spirits coexisting in one body can be separated from each other as easily as bodies can. However greatly bodies or spirits may be divided or separated from each other throughout the universe, they always remain united in this separation, because the whole creation is always just one substance or entity, with no vacuum in it. Quite generally, creatures are united with one another, so that no one of them can be separated from its fellow creatures. There's also a much more special unity among the parts of one species in particular. When a body is divided and its limbs are separated by a certain distance, as long as the limbs don't decompose and change to another species, they always send out tiny particles to each other and to the body the limbs came from. And that body emits similar particles, which can be called spirits and bodies, or spirits, for they are both. With these particles as intermediaries, the visibly separated limbs and other parts always retain a certain real unity and coordination of events, as many examples show. Two in particular. A man with no nose arranged to have a nose made for him from the flesh of another man, and fastened to him, like grafting a cutting onto the trunk of a tree. When the other man died and his body rotted, that nose also rotted and fell from the face of the living man. Second example, a surgeon amputated a man's leg and put it across the room from the body. The man was overcome by pain, and pointed out where in the severed leg the pain was, which clearly proves that the parts are in a certain way united even when separated by some distance. Likewise, individuals of the same species, or ones that belong to different species but have an affinity, may be united in a special way, even when they are distant from one another. This is especially evident in the case of human beings. If two people love each other very much, this love unites them so closely that no distance can divide or separate them. They are present to each other in spirit, so that a continual flow or emanation of spirits passes from one to the other, uniting them as if it were roping them together. Thus anything that someone loves, another person, an animal, a tree, silver, gold, is united with him, and his spirit goes out into it. Incidentally, although an individual human being's spirit is usually spoken of as one single thing, it is really composed of many spirits, countless spirits, just as the human body is composed of many bodies. The body's parts are organized into a certain ordered hierarchy, and this is even more so with the human spirit, a great army of spirits that have their different functions under one spirit, their commander. It now turns out that impenetrability and indivisibility are no more essential attributes of body than of spirit, because taken in one way, these attributes apply to both body and spirit, while taken in the other way, they apply to neither. It's the nature of a creature that if it is to act and enjoy the good that the Creator prepared for it, it can't be merely singular. To see that this is true, try to suppose that it isn't. Let's suppose there is one atom separated from all fellow creatures. What can it do to perfect itself and become greater or better? What can it see or hear or taste or feel, either within itself or outside? It can't see, hear, taste, or feel within itself, because that would involve internal motion. And it can't have internal motion, because that would involve its parts going from one arrangement to another. Whereas our atom is strictly singular, and doesn't have parts. It can't see, hear, taste, or feel any other creature, because for that it would have to receive an image of that other creature within itself. And it can't do that, because it's only an atom, and is so small that it can't receive anything inside itself. Just as the organs of the external senses are made up of many parts, so are the organs of the internal senses. So all knowledge requires that the creature that has the knowledge, the subject of the knowledge or its receptacle, consist of a variety or multitude of things. I mean all creaturely knowledge, i.e. knowledge received from or caused by the items that are known, in contrast with God's knowledge, which isn't received from or caused by creatures, but is basically His, coming from Him alone. We have knowledge of many different objects, each of which sends us its own image. So we have many images in us, each of them a real entity that needs a place within us that is right for its particular form and shape. And there is no way that could be provided by an atom. If we didn't house images in that way, not only would confusion follow, but many things would be present one to another without any extension, which is against the nature of a creature. Here is a possible line of thought. You contend that I am a multiple being who receives many images from objects. Because of this supposed multiplicity, if I know some one object, I should see it as if it were multiple, seeing many men instead of just one, for example. That is just wrong. A multiple knower doesn't automatically make what is known multiple, as the following two examples show. When many people see one man, they don't see him as many men, but only as one, despite the fact that they as a group are clearly multiple. When I look at something, I see it with my two eyes, but what appears to me is one thing, not two. If I could see a horse or a man, say, with 10,000 eyes, instead of my actual two, what appeared to me would be a single horse or man, no more than that. Our multiplicity seems to be the great difference between God and creatures. He is one, and he has the perfection of not needing anything from outside himself, whereas a creature needs the help of its fellow creatures, and must be multiple if it is to receive this help. I am not here repeating my point about multiplicity and knowledge of other things. My present point is specifically about receiving help, or more precisely, it is about receiving. Whenever something X receives something Y, it is nourished by Y, which thus becomes part of X. Therefore, even supposing that at the outset X is not multiple at all, X is now no longer one thing but many, at least as many as the things it receives. So creatures form a kind of social group devoted to giving and receiving, where one creature X supports another creature Y, so that Y can't live without X. What creature is there anywhere that doesn't need its fellow creatures? None. Thus every creature with any life, sense, or motion must be multiple or numerous, so much so that its multiplicity outruns the counting or listing capacities of every created intellect, meaning that its multiplicity is in the everyday sense of the term infinite. Here's another possible line of thought. A central or ruling spirit must be a single atom. Why else would it qualify as a central or principal spirit with dominion over all the rest? That is wrong. The central ruling or principal spirit is multiple, and I have already given the reason why it must be. It qualifies as central because all the other spirits come together in it, just as lines from every part of the circumference of a circle meet in the center and go out from it. In fact, the spirits that make up this central predominant spirit are more firmly and tenaciously held together than are the other spirits, the ones that are like messengers or executives for the principal spirit, the leader. This unity within the dominant spirit is so great that nothing can dissolve it, whereas most of the servant spirits, the ones not part of the central spirit, can separate. That's how it comes about that the soul of every human being will remain a whole soul for eternity, lasting for ever, so that it may receive proper rewards for its labour. This is required by the universal law of justice that is inscribed in everything, and serves as an extremely strong and unbreakable bond in keeping this unity among the parts of the central or dominant spirit in a human being. Spirits that agree and unite in doing good or bad will be rewarded or punished together. What can fit infinite justice and wisdom better than that? And it can't happen if they are separated from each other. For the same reason, the central spirit of every other creature is also indissoluble. New central spirits are continually being formed in the production of things, but no central spirit is dissolved. It can only be further advanced or diminished according to its current worthiness or unworthiness, capacity or incapacity. End of chapter 7.